three big benefits that people are going to receive from the Down 40 Love podcast. Number one, you're going to be inspired. These conversations with great people like American film producer Hawk Koch are like positivity pills that give you the energy to go out and crush your goals. Number two, you're going to build resilience. Down 40 Love is a tennis metaphor for turning adversity into competitive advantage. On the podcast, we share stories, strategies, and actionable steps so that you not only stay in the game, but you elevate your game to the next level. And three, you're going to get better. Listen, there's nothing worse than wasted potential. As a leader, you already know that, and it's also your greatest fear. By listening to Down 40 Love and applying the lessons to what's going on in your life, you'll become a master at turning setbacks into bounce backs and much, much more. Are you ready? Let's go. Peter, okay. Welcome to Down 40 Love.
Thank you. Good to see you this morning.
It's good to see you. You know, I'm fascinated with your story and I am enamored with your energy. And I want to thank you again for taking time out from your morning run. I don't know if it's in Central Park or wherever, but I know how committed you are to your health and fitness game. And I'm really looking forward to digging into your story and getting your best strategies and tactics around what it takes to build a resilient life. Why don't we start with just your story, your journey from Romania to the United States?
Well, I'll try to make it short because it's like anybody who is born around a war, let alone a major war, has lots of stories, because that's just the way that life is. If you got out, if you made it out, you got stories. And so as short as I can make it, born out of Romanian parents, I was born in 39, just as the Second War was bubbling. And my parents, who lived in Bucharest, my father was a petroleum engineer, and he ran the largest oil field at that time, probably in the world, which was owned by Standard Oil of New Jersey, Exxon. And so they smelled that trouble was coming from Germany and the Nazis. So they shipped my brother, 5 years older than I, to my grandparents in Transylvania, in a small town. My grandfather used to be governor of Transylvania. And in fact, he fought the Austro-Hungarian Empire during the First World War. But he was now mid-70s. And so that was my parenting, was this 6 years during the war that I lived with my grandparents. My father was eventually arrested by the Nazi regime in Romania. My father became an agent working with the OSS. My mother was the courier, and he had a control out of Istanbul. Interestingly, that man, Frank Wisner, was one of the people who started the CIA years later, and his son became one of my best friends and classmates at college. Anyway, that was Romania with my grandfather. We're reunited after the war. My father faced the firing squad once. That's another story, but he survived. And we were reunited for about close to a year. In 46, we were a family, two boys with their parents. And that's the longest I've ever spent with my parents in my life. And then in early 1947, he came to New York with my mother. And for a 2-week trip, there was a general manager's meeting at Exxon in New York City at the Rockefeller 30 Rock. And that's when the Iron Curtain comes down. So now he gets to his friend, Frank Wisner, who now is involved with the new CIA, and says, I got to dash back to Romania to protect my kids. And they tell him, my good friend, they said, you can't go back to Romania. We saw the list. You're close to the top, both you and your wife, are close to the top to be arrested and killed. So what's the point? So anyway, after a struggle to convince him about that, he relented and they stayed in the U.S., which of course is what saved us. Meanwhile, in Romania, we started with the communists, and I was, at the beginning, I attended school. I wore the red cravat of the pioneers, and eventually they arrested my grandfather in the middle of the night. They took him to a prison and eventually killed. They also killed about 300,000 influentials in Romania. My father and mother would have been among them. Business people, religious people, cultural, anybody they thought could be a potential threat to them, they arrested and they killed them. Not in a, they learned from the Germans, towers or with poisons in it. They underdressed them. They made them work in the fields to build a canal to nowhere. There was no canal going anywhere. They just worked, dug in about 2 years, underfed, underclothed. They're gone. My father was killed in prison. My grandfather was killed in prison. And shortly thereafter, they arrested my grandmother and my brother and myself. They put us in a small town close to the Soviet border. My grandmother was in house arrest. She couldn't leave the house. They took a room out of somebody's house and said, "That's your room. That's your new home." A bunch of hay was our bed, a bunch of blankets, a small oil stove. I mean, you know, like 10 inches by 10 inches. That was it. Outhouse in the back, a well that you had to pump water, fresh water. And you went to work at 6 o'clock in the morning, came back around 6 o'clock at night. You shopped at the only store in town, which was state-owned. And the amount of food you got was rationed. And the card that you had, the color of the card or your ration card, determined how much food you were going to get. And the first, well, throughout, I had the blue card, which was the highest ranked, because I cleaned sewers first for a bunch of years and a few years. And then I dug holes for electric poles and I worked on high tension wires. So it was hard labor, hard labor. And I needed calories and I never got quite enough. You know, it was a couple of slices of bread, some almost the same meal every day. Sort of smoked bacon, mostly fat, but that was all right, that's calories. And so many ounces of milk. And that was that. No books, no nothing. We just went to work, came back 6 days a week. On Sundays was the day off. We just pretty much slept throughout the day. And that was 5 years of it. And it was challenging because in between about every 3 months or so, we were dragged into somebody's office, a secret policeman's office. I was a little kid. And they used to yell at us about our parents, how bad they were, traitors to the country, how awful this whole thing was. And you know, that's their fault that you're here. The irony of what they said did not seem to penetrate their skulls. By the way, they were separated. My brother and I were not in the same room during those sessions where I was alone. I don't know how my brother handled that situation. We never discussed our work, never discussed what happened in those rooms together. We just held hands and went back home to my grandmother. But I know what I did, and I fought. And inside of me, I was freaking terrified. I was shaking. I was hoping I wouldn't show that. But the outer me was to scream back at them. So I was like a little poodle, you know, going for the ankles. And it made me feel good for sure. But I was really scared because they could have done anything to me. I was never beaten physically, but psychologically, they did everything they could to intimidate to made me compliant, to made me say, well, you're right, my parents are bad people, etc. They never succeeded in that. And then Stalin died, and things began to change somewhat. But the work, the routine, everything happened. What was hard is not to have any contact to the outside world. Nothing. No people. Nobody would talk to us. The people we work with were instructed not to talk to us, not to communicate. So back in New York, 7 years later, they came to my father, said, okay, you want to see your children again? You're going to spy for us. Simple as that. And my dad said, well, I became an American citizen. He said, not a problem for us. So he went home, said, I'll think about this. Talked to my mother. Must have been a hell of a night for them. What do you do? And went to the FBI the following morning, said, this is what happened. What do I do? I'm an American citizen. I'm not going to betray my new country. And they said, well, become a double agent. My dad demurred. He said, look, I've seen that play before. Never ends well. Sooner or later, I can do something. They'll kill the kids. So they agreed on another strategy, which is to go public. At that time, the Russians wanted the world to know that they were so much more civilized, better than America. So the Cold War was in full bloom. And so they said, the odds are high that the Russians will tell the Romanians, you can't kill those kids because the world knows now we got them. So that's not a good thing. So he said, tell the American people the story. And that's your best insurance policy to keep the kids alive. And then we'll try to figure out something to see what the hell we can do. Anyway, so that's what they did. They told my dad, well, if the story doesn't catch on, we'll help frame it. We know some people in media, so we get somebody to write a story. Well, no need for that, because every little town in America, it just caught on. It was one of those very simpatico stories that every human being felt what it could be like or would be like for a parent to be in the position that my parents were, and let alone American citizens at that. One of the people who read the story was this woman from Ohio, Frances Payne Bolton. Amazing woman. There's a story there all for her. She was the richest woman in America, took over. There's a long story about that, but to make it short, she took over her husband's role in Congress, who died. He died. He was the congressman from a region of Cleveland. He died in office. They asked her to become, to fill up his space over a few months. And they would tell her after 3 or 4 months who the right candidate, who the right male would be to take over. When they came to her, she said, thank you, boys, very much. I'll run myself. So she was the only woman in Congress at the time, in the House. So she became head of the Foreign Relations Committee. She met with Stalin, came back and said, and helped Eisenhower get elected because the favorite son from Ohio, Taft, she thought was not up to who Stalin was. And at the convention, she played a very important role in that area. Anyway, another story. So she picks up the phone when she read about my brother and myself and my parents. She was from Ohio, congresswoman from Ohio, calls my dad up in New York City and said, don't worry, Mr. Georgescu, I'll get your boys out. All my life, up to today, I keep asking myself, why? Why did she do that? She's a congresswoman from Ohio, for Christ's sake. My dad was in New York, a New Yorker. He was also an American. And she said to him, told him one time, nobody does that to American people and gets away with it. That's who she was. She did it, I concluded, because she could. And that was enough. There was a need there. And she did it. And after a year of trying diplomacy and so forth, she ended up in Ike's office. And I presume she said, Ike, get the boys out. Anyway, best we can tell, retrospectively. And I talked to CIA folks years and years later. We probably got traded for a bunch of Russian spies. That's what happened. There was a letter written to the prime minister of Romania, communist, but underneath this, there was a trade. And so age 15, April 13th, 1954, my brother and I arrived at Idlewild Airport, facing a couple hundred cameras pointed at us. And for about 10 days, we were everywhere. Every television show, radio shows, newspapers, and like everything else in the world, certainly in America, 10 days later, boom, curtain comes down. You're an average Joe. Nobody knows who you are, which, of course, is very healthy. But again, it helped because the principal of Exeter called my dad up and said, I'll keep a place for your young boy if you're interested. And what an agonizing decision must have been for my mother, particularly with her two boys. We were little kids. I was 6.5 years old when they left Romania. And now I was 15, tall, young, and I was no longer a boy. I was a man. And the same, obviously, with my brother. And they agreed to let me go to a boarding school. That was hard. I didn't speak a word of English, and I had a fourth grade education. But the principal said to my parents, you help them learn English. This is mid-April. And we'll meet in August, have dinner at Exeter, and we'll go from there. We went there. We had dinner. He clearly liked me. He said to me, I remember this. I don't remember the chit-chat or how he determined that he liked me. But anyway, there was no way to test me. I had no competence in the language. I didn't have any skills academically. But he liked me. And he said, look, if you pass your courses on your own without any consideration for your background, you get to stay. Otherwise, I'll find the right school for you. I had no clue what he was talking about. I was smart enough to say, yes, sir. And that's okay. On the way out the door, he says to me, by the way, what grade would you like to be? Again, I said, I didn't know what grade was. I got a sense that he had to be something with my age, my whatever. And I said, I'd like to be in with boys my own age. So he thought for a second. Smile came to his face, threw up his hands, and said, what difference does it make? You will be a sophomore, a lower middle, a sophomore at Exeter. So I went to Exeter for 3 years because I said that. But after that, it was, that's the end of the story in America, because my background, because after that, I was just another American kid who got, nobody basically knew who I was. I was an immigrant. There were some foreign kids. Not many. And surely I got help. The universe provided with help. Teachers paid attention to me. No serious consideration, no special, nothing. I had a two or three session of language therapy, which is why I probably don't have the accent that my brother has or had before he died. And by the way, my brother worked for the NSA and the CIA most of the time. He was a language scholar. He spoke Arabic and Farsi and whatnot. He was an analyst, not a spook. He was not the kind, but he was a very smart dude and spoke many languages. So anyway, after that, you know, I went to Princeton, graduated with honors, and went to Stanford Business School, and life was, I was clearly an out of it socially. I mean, I had no experiences or social skills other than with very sophisticated parents with whom I saw mostly on vacations. And eventually they went to, my father was moved to London for his job. So the company paid for a trip for us to see our parents. That was part of the deal, his deal. And that was that. And the rest then, I went into business. I rejected my dad, wanted me to go in the oil business. By accident, I got into marketing communication business. That's another long story. And I spent 40 years there. And I came in as a trainee and eventually ended up, I was one of the first non-Americans to run a major company in the States at the time. And then I stopped doing that. I went to a bunch of boards. I began to understand inequality in America and became deeply immersed in that battle and recognized that it was up to business to help fix inequality. People look to government to fix the problem. Government has no money nor the ability to do that. Business does. So today I'm spending a lot of time. I work in healthcare. I volunteer for a hospital. I was chair of a large hospital. Did many other things, ventures, 7 public company boards, et cetera. But my main passion is to help America's business choose a better version of capitalism, because that's the only way we can really fix the level of inequality that exists in America. And it's not an issue of wealth redistribution. It's an issue of a system where everybody wins, that business can do even better, and workers get paid more, not just for moral reasons, because that's a smart business thing to do. And I understood how that works and why that's right. And that's what I keep doing right now. And if you are, and I'm driven by a passionate sense of purpose that I'm here to try to do something constructive and to help this country that gave me so much, and to act the way so many people, I call them guardian angels, and we all had them, by the way. If anybody listens to your podcast and is modestly successful, they've had lots of guardian angels helping them. They never did it by themselves. I know that much about life. And I had my share of those people, and I'm so consciously aware. I've often thought of why this woman from Ohio, Congresswoman, call my dad? Why did the principal of Exeter call this kid with a 4th grade education and no English to come to his school? Made no sense. And yet, that's what we are all called for, to be on the lookout, to do what we can to make the world a better place, to make this country a better country, to help your family, to help your friends, to help anybody in need of help you can. And I'm no saint, but I've been gifted, my horrible early background, gifted, because I understood life. I understand that human beings, I have learned where we came from. That famous jungle in Africa, that's where we all came from. We're all born black because we all live there. But some of us got away earlier from the sun. And that's who we are. And those genes that once we came down from the trees and learned to become bipedal, and what it took for us to survive in that environment. Let us think about that. We had to learn to do some pretty tough, cruel things. And those genes are there with us, along with the genes of kindness and thoughtfulness and concern. And we wake up every morning, all of us, trying to determine what are we today, What are we going to do? And I wrote a bunch of books, mostly about business, but one of them was about good and evil, where I met good and evil. And what I'm proudest of is the title, called The Constant Choice. And I'm proud of that because I'm so aware of and conscious of how should I act today, or when I encounter a problem, when I encounter most any situation of seriousness, I do step back in my mind, in the back of my mind, sometimes consciously, sometimes not consciously anymore, instinctively, to figure out, who am I? How do I behave? And so the constant choice is a game of life for all of us, consciously or otherwise. And we all come at it. We all have stories. Let me tell you, everybody has a story in this world. Some of us are more fortunate than others and so forth and so on. Some of us have hard beginnings. Some of us have learned to cope with that. I call myself very fortunate. I look at my background with gratitude, that life has given me an opportunity to understand what the game is, what the really game of life is. So that's about as quick as I can make it, Renee. So I apologize for rambling on, but that's my story.
Peter, what does Down 40 Love mean to you?
Down 40 Love is who I was in my early days. Down 40 means you're at close to the end of the rope there. It may very well be, in my case, I look at Down 40 Love in the fifth set, not in the first set. In the first set, you have an excuse. Okay, so there will be another set, but not in the fifth set. And so I put myself kind of in that position. I happen to love tennis. And as an observer, yeah, I played a little bit, but I never had time to be any good. But God, did I love it. And I learned the game, the subtleties of the game. I look for the strategies. I even almost enjoy women's tennis as much as, if not more than, men's tennis, because you can see the strategic need. They just can't end a point that quickly, most of them. So they employ more strategy, and I love to see how those points get made and won and so forth. So I become a student of tennis. So I've never been to Roland Garros in France, but other than that, we've been to all the other major tournaments, and I love tennis, but I understand what it feels like inside when it's 40 love against you, and how you have to react to that with a calmness and certainty. May or may not win, but you're now ready, prepared, and to figure out, okay, this is a tough one, but there has to be a way out. And in that those few seconds, you come up with a plan and you go at it.
Peter, you mentioned the word strategy. Can we pivot to your experience as a successful CEO and leader? Can you talk to us about leadership and strategy, and maybe share how we can use strategy to maximize potential?
Well, I think I'm a deep believer in strategy, because in any game, in any role you play in life, whether you're in business or in your personal life, or whether you're father or a parent or a grandparent, whatever, you have to have a sense of how do you play the role that you are. And every day, there's a strategic component to how I prepare myself for the day. And yes, I learned that you have to be really seriously good at execution, because strategy by itself obviously does not end the day. You have to execute. But execution without a strategy is useless. There's no ability to win consistently without strong strategic ability. So I think that's where it all begins. I spend my business life really looking at strategy as a leader for my own company. I understood the power of values. I understood that for our company to succeed, particularly in the creative business, we had to learn as a company how to help make every single employee we had be the best that he or she could be. And that was, again, a strategy. It was not just a tactic. We had to create a spirit and then create a culture of what it took to sustain and drive every day to become better, to have a new goal, new purpose, to invent and reinvent ourselves. Reinvention is a strategy. You have to go out there and say, okay, here's how we did it. This is where we are. This is what we did well. And recognize that the world around you changes all the time and you have to change with it. And somehow, as I see in tennis, you see the new tennis players, they all seem to be younger, stronger, almost taller, faster. Obviously, there are exceptions and all that. But you know what I mean? They're tougher. They're tougher competitors. You see how in tennis, there are three guys who just dominated for 20-some years the world of tennis. I mean, they won 67 or 68% of every major tournament was won by one of those three people. And so, you know, I think that world, I don't think we're going to see that world anymore, because the competition has gotten so much tougher, so many more better players than there were back then. So anyway, the point is you have to reinvent yourself. And you have to reinvent the company. And I was in a service business. And so my whole life was dedicated, and certainly me personally, because I was not the writer or the art director or the producer of communications, but my job was to create for my clients the strategic direction that would help them become better at whatever it is that they did. So strategy for me was everything.
Peter, what advice would you have for emerging leaders within companies or even entrepreneurs who want to grow their careers and, you know, expand and scale their businesses?
I think in any business, you have to understand, first of all, you have to, strategy comes from knowledge. You have to understand your environment. You have to understand the customer. There's always a customer or consumer about anything. So you have to start there and understand what is it that they need or they want in this particular area that you're thinking about. And then think about the environment. What other competitors they may be out there? How are they doing? Where are they missing? What are the open opportunities? If you understand the customer particularly well, what are the current people, current competitors not doing? What are the opening possibilities? Or if there are weaknesses in how they deliver, even if some of their objectives are being filled, but not to the satisfaction that you think it should be or could be. What's more really important and leverageable and a driver that you can pick up? Again, back to strategy. But strategy is not born out of nothing. It's born out of extraordinary amount of discipline, rigorous research and knowledge. And that's what it takes. It's really hard work. So you have to go through all of that and a simple idea in your head and say, okay, I love my idea and therefore let's go do it. No, that's not how you're going to wind up. That's why you'll con a lot of people to give you big money and you're going to lose, because you know a lot of people are also in the same game in today's world. Not there are very few freebies, very few people who discovered brand new ways that nobody's ever thought of. So you have to have a lot of knowledge, a lot of spade work. And then importantly, you have to create the environment for success. And again, understand the power of people. If you understand your customers very well, understand your people and the people you work with, your colleagues, the people you're responsible for, and your clients, what do they need, and the ultimate consumer. So a lot of work goes into being successful. But again, at the end of the day, you almost never, unless you win the lotteries a lot, you're not going to win without really being good at the strategic planning of how you do battle, how you fight, and how you win, and how you keep winning consistently over time. To invent, to reinvent. In my career, it will amuse you. In my career, I start to make speeches at the end by saying, if it ain't broke, fix it. That was my motto. If it ain't broke, fix it.
Can you operationally define that for us or give us an example?
Well, the meaning of that is very simple. Don't count on your laurels because you're good at something. Because sooner or later, that something's going to be broken. And so if you want to stay ahead of the game, you got to anticipate. You got to change before it's necessary for you. Because if you wait for the problem to arrive, for your situation to get worse, the steepness of the curve on the upper end of the solution is that much more difficult. So understand where you are, and you can't declare victory because you are where you are. You have to keep constantly looking ahead to the next level, and the next level, and the next level. And like the rock of Sisyphus, you just keep pushing the rock up there. But you understand that that's what you got to do. So get ready for it. Yeah, and I get up in the morning and I do go to Central Park. I live 2 blocks from the Central Park. Thank you, my wife, who got me away from the East River where I used to live, but the fumes were not good for me. Now I run in the trees in the park and I'm much better off. But I have to do that to stay in the game.
Complacency is a disease. You remind me of Novak Djokovic, who in his prime hired a volley coach. And you're a tennis fan, and you know implicitly that Djokovic rarely comes to the net to hit volleys. Yet he did an audit on his game and made the decision that he needed to improve this one area. Where he spends very little time, you know, during competition. Is that what you've seen in terms of a leader's demise and companies really going down the tubes? Would it be because they've fallen or given in to complacency?
All the time. All the time. It's very hard when you're very successful to do what I've just said. If it ain't broke, they usually say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Keep on trucking, man. Keep doing what you're doing. and that's, I've taught myself that that's an unnatural place to be. You cannot be satisfied with what is. You have to change. You have to improve. You have to find, because the law of the jungle says again and again and again, things will change. They do all the time. And knowing that and preparing yourself to change is critically important. And of course, there's an art form to that. When you change, how you get your team, your company, your colleagues to follow you, because you can't do it just by yourself. You got to prepare, depending how large the organization is. You got to educate. You got to convince people to play along with you.
Yeah.
So it's not, again, it's a strategic decision, and you have to, it's complicated. But at the end of the day, if you're a leader, that's your job. That's your job.
Yeah.
If you want to leave behind, now if you plan to say, well, I got it to here, I'll stay another year or a year and a half or 2 years, then I'm out of there. Well, if that's your attitude, fine. Let somebody else coming in and pick up the pieces to where you left it. But if it's your business, or if you really care, not only the company and yourself, but your employees, your people, you owe them that too. So I think you have multiple stakeholders at all times, in your personal life, in your business life. And very seldom do you say, okay, I'm going to trade off and forget these people, and I'm going to worry only about these people. Not a winning strategy. So, you know, I'm sorry, life is not easy. Life is not simple. If you want easy and simple, then be a seriously better skill at picking your parents.
Go play golf.
Oh, go play. Yeah, but you better pick the right people so you can go play golf. But that's a different skill. I don't know about that skill.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily that easy, obviously. But it's definitely less strenuous on the body. They can't make that argument. Peter, I mean, the insight that, you know, that I've taken, you know, from the last few minutes, you know, initially was, you know, that's the beauty of sports, right? The, you know, when you're an athlete, you know, or a coach like myself working with top performers, you don't have to be too creative to set new goals. The goals are basically set for you. And every time you check the box, something else pops up. You know, there's always a next horizon. But it's not only the beauty of sports, and it's not the beauty of business. It's really the beauty of competition, you know, and I think that's why we're in the game. It's the beauty of challenging ourselves to grow each and every day. Like, that's what makes it fun. And I think, and you can attest to this, and you could share with us if you've seen this in your business life. But, you know, a lot of the top leaders in corporate stay in the game because they're just so competitive. It's like, I coach collegiate tennis for a reason, because we're competing every single day. You don't get that same type of competitive challenge or edge teaching at a country club. you know, or at your local tennis club. It's not the same. For me, it's the competitive drive. It's the opportunity to go up and to show what you've got, you know, on a daily and a weekly basis, almost, you know, throughout the year. And when the fire stops burning there, then it's time to look for something else. And the reason why I bring this up is because I want to pivot to, you talked about the acquisition of purpose. Once you segued from Young and Rubicam, you know, more into, I don't know how you would put it, but maybe your private life, or just the next phase, or the next quarter, or the next set in your life. Can you share with us what that looked like for you as you've reinvented yourself over the last 10 to 15 years?
Yeah. I just want to say that we all have to, the first, because you asked me actually two questions. One was, what level do you want to play? Do you want to, or what level of competition do you feel comfortable with? Not everybody wants to do what you do, or what I have done, or what it takes to run major corporations, or etc. Not everybody needs to do that. But I think the principles of what we have been talking about are generally the same. You just may not need the level of intensity or the level of the rapidity of change that is required if you're in a very competitive environment. So everybody, and I'm not even suggesting that that's what you have to do to necessarily thrive to be at the most competitive level in the world. That's not true. And it's not right. It depends on your personality, depends on your talent. Some of them are inborn, a lot of them that you pick up and as you go along. So that's one thing. Life is not necessarily needs to be a struggle to be the best in the universe or the best in the world. You should be happy with doing what gives you satisfaction in the accomplishments that you can get and declare victory on that, I think. Now, in my case, you see, the way I look at things, I never deserve to have the skills and the knowledge that I've acquired in my life. They happened, the circumstances of life presented me with those challenges, and I've been fortunate enough with a lot of help from others to succeed at that level. And so you get used to a level of competition, if you will, that comes along, and you determine at what level you want to play. But I think at some point in time, in my case, as I became a little bit more mature, when I was in business, the purpose was not, trying to search for a purpose was not quite necessary. It was too obvious. And I knew the game of business, and I knew what it took to win. So I tried to be the best I knew how to be in that area. Not the best. There are a lot of more successful people than I am. That's fine. All I care about is being the best I knew how to be and to understand why I was doing what I was doing. So in some ways, purpose or strategy was always part of it. When I left the business world, I made a strategic decision that I would leave the business world. That was a strategic decision, not a tactical one. I had done what I wanted. I felt I achieved decent success. And I didn't want to just keep repeating what I've done. But while I was doing it for the sake of my company and my colleagues and my clients, I never thought about what I was going to do next. So I just left. Tabula rosa, start from scratch. And then all of a sudden, as a human being of a certain age, in my, I was just about 60 or so. So my early mid 60s, the question came to me to say, Peter, why the hell are you on this earth? Eating bonbons? Is that it? And I was a father. I was beginning to shortly thereafter become a grandfather. And so I this question started to haunt me. So that was sort of, again, the strategy was to find a way that would answer the question of why am I here? And again, it was a strategic decision. It was a choice that I made in terms of how can I best use my skills, my experience, and my knowledge to optimize myself and try to make a difference in a constructive and positive way. And it worked for me. But every day, there are some times when you want to pull the alarm rings and you want to pull the cover over your head. And then you know that you can't do that because you're here for a purpose. And most of the work is just work. It's hard work. It's not the triumphant speech that you're going to make or great decision that you make that day or whatever. Some of those come along, but they're short-lived. That's not a game. That's not what you're living. You try to accomplish something bigger than you, that's enduring beyond you. And I think life is not no longer achieving a goal. Life and of purpose is the journey. And so I am on this journey, and as long as I'm around for whatever, however it is, I'm going to keep doing it until I don't. And that gives me a lot of purpose. That kind of purpose or choice gives me meaning and satisfaction.
So could you share or define what your purpose is in maybe one or two sentences for us?
Well, right now, I spent about 10 years after I wander around. I wrote a couple of books about business and myself and blah, blah, blah. And then I became obsessed almost with the reality of inequality in America. And it's amazing how uneducated, undereducated I was about it. And I think many leaders, business leaders, might I dare say most, have no clue what's really happening in America or what has happened in America for the last 40 years and how business has negatively impacted, how the choice of the wrong version of capitalism have created this disastrous, disastrous reality, which today financial people would say this is systemic risk. What systemic risk is those things you can't control, like social instability. As a business player, you don't control that. So you think. But that's where we are today. And we're in a challenging situation. And we first have to understand the problem. And I was lucky. I spent a lot of time trying to understand the problem. I do understand the problem. I do understand that we have to change the version of capitalism that got us for the last 40 years. That's not what built America, this version of shareholder primacy, that is, maximize short-term shareholder value. That's what happened the last 40 years. That's what created America as the most unequal nation in the developed world and the most socially immobile society in the developed world. That's what happened in the last 40 years. And business was principally the unfortunate driver of that inequality. And business is the only institution that can really address it and fix it. So we have to not give up on capitalism, because that's the best system that can give us, but go to an earlier version of capitalism that built America from the Second World War to the mid-80s. And think of many more stakeholders, the customers, the workers, the shareholder, the corporation itself, the communities. Now, let's think about the planet too. That's the bigger home we need to worry about. So there are about six or so stakeholders that we need to worry about, and everyone needs to be optimized, not maximized, optimized. So it's a different game that we have to play. And the good news is, if we do that, the shareholders are even bigger winners. The workers are bigger winners. Communities are also are going to thrive better. So is the planet. So, yeah, everybody can win at this game. But if you think that's easy and obvious, forget it. Change is hard. People really don't understand. They think, oh, if I don't focus on maximizing short-term profits, I'm not doing right by the shareholders. Not true. The shareholder gets cheated in that game. And you have to understand why. And in creating inclusive prosperity, which is the game, the ultimate game for America, for America's democracy, is to have inclusive prosperity. We must do that. We cannot, and we must educate our people better. The level of education in America is abysmal. We rank at the bottom of the developed world in terms of education. Unconscionable. So there's a lot of work to do. I'm not going to see it all get that much better in my lifetime. But if I can just contribute whatever I can, that's my purpose.
Isn't it ironic that with the hardship and the oppression that you experienced as a child and overcame, that now your purpose and your passion and your practical actions on a day-to-day basis are all toward solving inequality and just helping people live the lives that they deserve, here yes. on this earth. It's funny
and
how
certainly in this country. And yeah. certainly in this country.
It's funny how we come full circle often.
We do. You're right. You're right, Coach. You got it.
Thank you for that. Peter, what do you want your legacy to be?
I don't care about my legacy.
Have you been hanging out with Jack Welch? I think Jack Welch is the only other CEO who probably had the same answer to that question. I mean, what do you want your kids and your grandkids to think about you when you are no longer physically on this planet? What would you like them to think about Peter Georgescu?
I would like them to think that I try to be, with all my failings, and as a father and grandfather, I'm sure I got a long list of inadequacies. But I like them to think not so much about me that way, but for them to think that it's important to do something well and do it with compassion, with caring for others, and that I would wish for them to be like that. Not like me, to be the best that they can be, to be caring, to be values focused in their lives for themselves and for their kids. That's how I want. That idea makes me really happy.
Well, Peter, I want to thank you for sharing your experiences, your stories, your example of a life of resilience. You know, we've talked a lot off camera just about your journey, and it really is a special one. And I hope going forward, you know, we can continue our conversations because I can learn, you know, so much from you in a short period of time. And I'm truly grateful for you being a guest on Down 40 Love.
Thank you so much. And as I was fortunate enough to meet you, to read your book, and to know your story. So it was a privilege for me as well. Godspeed.
Thank you, Peter. Hey, before you go, thanks so much for listening. If you got value from this show, chances are your community will too. Please share this link with a friend or mention the podcast on social. That's a big time benefit for us, and hopefully in exchange for providing insight and big ideas to you. I also want to go the extra mile today and give you an opportunity to connect with me further by downloading a free copy of my new book, Down 40 Love, Private Lessons on Turning Adversity into Competitive Advantage. It's my personal manifesto on building resilience in every aspect of your life. Now go put today's episode into practice, because dominance is daily. Are you ready? Let's go.